Okay, I'm here with Cameron again and Cameron McEwen in California, and we're starting number seven or eight recording. So we're looking at my pamphlet, my broadside, my book in quotes, and Cameron has just listened again to what we said last week, especially the ending, and he has some interesting points to make. So I'll let Cameron lead.
All right. So first, I find your modern history interesting. And as we get into it, we'll be getting into your book. So that fits our purpose here perfectly. One of the things that I was interested in was your recourse, repeated recourse to disappearance, disappearance of the chemical body, disappearance of factual news, and those are things that I think are indeed happening. But I relate it to the cul-de-sac that we've entered into that is a kind of retracing of old ways of thought that don't lead anywhere. But people, including all of McLuhan research, have no idea of how to get out of these cul-de-sacs. It's as if they're in deep canyons. And what they need to think is immediately beside them, but in another canyon. And they simply do not know how to go from one canyon to another canyon, even though the human condition is nothing else but going from one canyon to another. Right? So you have this modern phenomenon of people are lost in what they most are.
Yes. Good.
But that's kind of getting aside from where we were. I think it was very interesting what you were saying about the Trump phenomenon, which is kind of a fog of unknowing in which people are trying to feel themselves around in by talking. But what they're talking about and what they're grasping is just this fog.
That's right. Well said.
I don't know if you want to take up from there or if I should.
I have something to say. I wrote in the spring of 2017, I wrote a short thing called How President Don Trump, I always called him Don rather than Donald, has different suggestions, how President Don Trump has become the first executive political leader to put on the shamanic tradition. So those that respect the shamanic tradition will say, that's ridiculous, Bob. The guy's a dumb asshole. He's no shaman. But in the McLuhan style, I'm saying what they're not expecting. And turns out that, you know, from the spring 2017, it's now 3.5 years, he has wiggled out of every situation. He's going to probably wiggle out of this loss and retrieve the White House. It was a big day today. A couple of the states have said, yep, we're going to have open hearings in decertification of the election. So he's always getting further than people expect. So that's kind of like a shaman, a guy that can't be trapped by the tribe. You know, he's above the tribe. Or sees through the tribe. And it's conditioning, and he plays off it. And that, as McLuhan says, new art is ugly. This may be why Trump is considered so, quote, evil and duplicitous. Mm-hmm. He's ugly, you know, because he's actually in a new mode beyond what I call the TV body, in the chip body, an Android me mode, that people can't place in the old venerable industrial literate institution of the White House. Can't put the two together.
Right.
So I found this really great quote. from interior landscape. So I said, I began by saying, no previous president of the USA has ever used the office of the White House to provide a training in perception in Western art. And this is partly, this is for, you know, schooled scholars of McLuhan. Those people know that that was McLuhan's favorite phrase. We're providing a training in perception, right? So I'm putting on the McLuhan cliches for those that know, have studied McLuhan and know the cliches. You see what I'm saying? So I'm saying,
yeah,
that's directed at the hidden audience of the McLuhanites. But for general people, they're going, what is a training in perception? How can that be? What is that? And then I said, in Western art, there are two schools or approaches to the creative act as spelled out by Marshall McLuhan. So the two schools are the cathartic ethical view of art and the cognitive view of art. The cognitive view of art came in 170 years ago. McLuhan said, would dare to look at popular culture and, what was considered crude, vulgar, and yet see patterns of popular culture and mirroring patterns in high culture. So the ethical view is looking at, McLuhan called it the vertical school of symbolism, and the cognitive school was the horizontal, and the cathartic ethical vertical school thought the world was ugly or fallen and was trying to get out of it. So if you look at pop culture as ugly and you're trying to get out of it, you go to the opera or something, or whatever was considered high culture.
Go where? I didn't hear
go to
that
the
word.
Opera or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Ballet. Yeah.
Whatever is considered high culture and not consider culture in the shop windows, which is what Baudelaire did in Flowers of Evil. At least that's what the critics tell me he did, you know, the people who studied him. So that's the vulgar world. So I suggest, since Trump is easily criticized on the ethical level, and that's all we got from then till now, what about the cognitive level, how people can't see what he's referring to? I like the idea that he ran unopposed because he got into the Twitter sphere, and George Bush and all those other old hacks weren't very good at that level. And he was, so he was a master of the new environment. Whatever mastery that is, I'm not sure, but it certainly worked for him. So we need to look at Trump as a cognitive phenomenon or as a perceptual problem, and the ethical doesn't work. So that was my point. And, you know, McLuhan beautifully laid it out. You can look at the beginning of my book and see that quote. It's one of the earliest quotes, and I don't want to go into it. I don't want to say it all now, but it's there. Take a look at it. And a lot of thought was put into those statements by McLuhan. So what do you think of that?
Taking
the cognitive approach. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just first a theoretical point. McLuhan did outline those two approaches, but he disagreed with both, right?
Yes.
He thought that both the vertical and the horizontal were Gnostic, were attempting some kind of false closure.
Yes.
Right. Where they differed vertically and horizontally was how they actually made the closure. So the vertical guys made a closure through mind, and the horizontal guys made a closure through emotion.
Yes.
And McLuhan wants to say that both of those closures are false, and they don't understand the dynamic between them. For McLuhan, there is no closure in life. The life itself is dynamic and includes these minor disruptions like horizontal and vertical. But leaving that aside,
how would you describe his solution? Or did he get to a solution, you know, the third way?
Yes, absolutely. one way of putting a solution is to jump to 1964. He's just finished Understanding Media, and he reads Wolfgang Kohler's book, Gestalt Psychology.
Mm.
And from that moment on, from 64 until 79, everything is figure ground for McLuhan.
Yes.
And so if we want to take horizontal and vertical, McLuhan shows that it's not that either one of those is the ground. Rather, there is a dynamic where the vertical can be figured on the ground of the horizontal, and there can be the horizontal figured on the ground of the vertical. And what's needed is to understand the range of that variation. And once the range of that variation is understood, then any phenomenon that is encountered in life can be seen to take up some possible position in that range. And then, given his view on all-at-onceness, what human being is not something vertical, is not something horizontal, but is a kind of stance in front of these perpetual possibilities of that range.
Yes.
But maybe we can come back to that at some point. But before I forget, I want to go back to what you were saying about Trump. I've been reading a book on Eskimos by a guy by the name of Pryde, P-R-Y-D-E, who lived with the Eskimos in the 50s and 60s and learned their Inuit language and and had kids with Eskimo women and stuff like that, and gives an interesting view of the Eskimo landscape as they were going from traditional life thousands of years old to a life with radios and rifles and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So
much like Tate Carpenter's experience, right?
That's absolutely right. So, but he talks about shamans. And shamans weren't necessarily sterling individuals, right? They they were feared by the tribe, but they really didn't understand themselves. And what they had to contribute was largely through trances and through being something other than this physical person.
Yes.
That everybody knew. And so to me, that description of a shaman fits what you were saying with Trump.
Yes.
I think that you were saying with Trump that the person of Trump, the chemical body of Trump, wasn't some great perceptualist, wasn't somebody who had figured out the movement of the world and was able to kind of use his understanding as a lever. Rather, he somehow impersonated beyond himself something that was alive now in the world and was not really grasped by anybody, but they were in the grasp of it.
Excellent. Well said. That's really good. Shamanic, what was it? So Carpenter, so this was written the same time as Carpenter?
Yeah, this I think book. So. Maybe a few years after Carpenter was up there.
Right.
This guy was, Carpenter, I think, was largely in the Hudson Bay region, and this guy was up in the Arctic on Victoria Island and Cambridge Bay up in there.
Right. Now, young people today may not know the word Eskimo. It's Inuit. They grow up in Canada with that term, right? The Inuit?
Yeah.
Yeah, so just so we're up to date on the change there. This point about the shaman goes into trance, what is the trance state of Trump is it possible he tranced? You know how McLuhan said in the mid-60s that modern man, or might later say postmodern man, he can't live in any culture because he's experiencing the media of so many different cultures and new media that he's perpetually detached or alienated and in a new hyper state of awareness. Remember that quote? We've talked about it before.
I don't remember it off the top of my head, but what you're saying makes great sense, right? I mean, if a person can't live in a culture but needs culture, then they're alienated from the human condition, and they're in a cul-de-sac.
Yes. Let's just see if I can bring it up. Multimedia, was that the term he used in that period? I have here a quote from Cliched Archetype. Today, the multimedia have, as noted, demobilized consciousness. We speak of a lie as credibility gap. It's not a lie, it's a credibility gap. Truth, once again, becomes trust, not Cartesian certainty. Let's see if there's another one. Nope. Okay. So,
that movement from Cartesian certainty to trust is what I was talking about earlier, of the movement from the vertical and the horizontal to something dynamic of both.
Right. So I'm scanning down through my my old book, where I have a lot of McLuhan quotes, to see if I can come across that one.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? You know, here's a quote from early 50s. Any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur, which must be slain by the hero artist. If you have, you can't get into the culture, the time, and have time to eat it, appetite becomes frustrated. You're not in a cultural framework for it. So it just occurred to me, thinking of that now, that people from the 60s, 70s on are chaotically hedonistic, trying to find a satisfaction of the new appetite inspired by this strange condition of not being in a culture anymore, any particular culture. Just occurred to me that point.
Sure. Well, if you look at PBS these days, it's almost nothing but eating.
Really?
Right. It's unbelievable. You turn it on and it's somebody who's doing Iranian cooking or Greek cooking, or some Canadian is in China doing dim sum cooking or something. It's unbelievable. It's just program after program after program of eating. And what's interesting is that they make something and that takes a few minutes. And then they start to eat it, and that takes a long time. And viewers get to see these people just eating, and then they say, "Oh, that's so delicious! Mmm, wonderful!" You know,
crazy.
If you take some distance to it, it's crazy. But that's all PBS is now.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So what would remember McLuhan said, I think Stephen Hero, Joyce, has the character say, the one thing that's common among all the different cultures on the planet was the digestive system.
Right.
So eating, chemical body eating, is the new Esperanto.
using Joyce there to talk about digestion in every sense.
Yes.
And he took Joyce to be talking about digestion in every sense. So not just physical eating, but intellectual eating. Everybody has to come to terms with the world. And so that's the basically digestion there is the drama of cognition.
Exactly. Now, I talk about it, putting in my five-body model. We have chemical body, stomach, astral stomach, TV body stomach, chip body stomach, and then the Android meme stomach. We've got five stomachs. So I've systematized what you just said.
Uh-huh. And do you is that the five stomachs? Do you see that as a diachronic model, that is to say, something that happens, that develops through time, or do you see it as the condition of humans all at once?
Now it's all at once. The chip body came after the TV body. The chip environment came after the analog media. If you don't get too metaphysical about it, there's a kind of a sequence there in our experience of it. But now they're all happening at the same time.
And right, but my inclination, and I think McLuhan's inclination, at least some of the time, was to say, okay, this now has to be all, like Eliot said, all is always now. So, no matter how these things came in sequence, if they came at all, they had to have a basis in possibility. So somebody might well not know that they have these five stomachs, but the five stomachs must have been there as a possibility, which then became realized in consciousness given certain conditions.
Now, why are they already there?
Well, if they weren't already there, how could they unfold at some time in history? It's like some very elaborate chemical preparation. Maybe it's never been made before in the history of the world, but it's possible to be made because of the underlying elements, which can be manipulated into that new chemical formulation.
Yes, McLuhan says somewhere, maybe in Take Today, that Joyce understood he can make a whole universe out of two words, or that every word in the language retrieves, echoes, and creates all the other words. So if technologies are like words, then you begin with speech, and you're going to get these extensions of different parts of the body and get to where we are today. And that's like the secret techno wisdom that Finnegan's Wake is showing. And that's like the most esoteric, McLuhan might say, percept or concept of what's going on. If you realize that if we blew up the world and then there's just a bunch of people with not much and maybe don't even have a memory of what happened eventually, they could start the process of invention again, starting with speech and early notation or text, as Derrida might call it, and unfold the extensions of our body faculties. That's an inevitable somnambulistic process. Does that fit your synchronic meaning of all inventions are implied?
I'm not so sure about that, because I don't see any inevitable sequence to these things. At any given time, you need to be able to understand why something happened in terms of what happened before. So, if we are trying to understand a chemical reaction in a laboratory, if some solution is in a beaker and then another solution is added to it, we have to be able to understand the combination or combustion of the two things in terms of the sequence of actions which led to it, right? There was this material, and then this material was added to it, and then this happened. So that kind of sequence is based on the possibilities that are built into elements. But there isn't any necessary sequence to it. if the world were blown up and there were some humans with language that survived or came from someplace else or whatever, there wouldn't be any necessary sequence to them, you know, inventing letters and inventing printing and inventing electricity and all that sort of stuff. That might be built into language as a possibility, but there's no necessity there.
Right. I guess I'm not saying that's inevitable, but if there's going to be progress, it would have to go through each level of the body faculties and then finally getting to extending the central nervous system. It might take 2,000 years or 10,000 years, but there may be no way to go unless there's there may be no other way to go unless there are technologies, and that's in the world of science fiction and fantasy, that would move us to think completely different ways. Whatever strange things that people could imagine. Actually, personally, I'm doing that with her cold fusion battery or box. It is based on something that regular scientific knowledge doesn't have. So we
a lot of your work, Bob, has been what you're a specialist in thinking outside of the box. People say, Bob is crazy, or Bob isn't really doing McLuhan, or Bob is doing whatever. But the interesting thing is that the need for McLuhan research, or the need for modern American history, which is a modern world history, as Wyndham Lewis was already saying in Cosmic Man, the need is to go from a way of thinking and a way of experiencing, which is extremely dangerous, which is nihilistic and is hell-bent on destroying the world, destroying civilization, conceivably destroying the biosphere. So the great need is to be able to think differently. And people, there's very few people like yourself that are saying, here's an example of thinking differently. Why don't you try to understand this? And I think that's at the very bottom of your book, actually, that it's an exercise in trying to think differently about stuff that you think you know.
Well, say it again. You should be my. I should put you on TV and do the interviews.
I forget the name of that guy that used to have ads on TV for. You have a can that doesn't open right. Well, I've got the magic can opener.
Yes. Is that a Canadian phenomenon or American? This ad.
I think the guy was from Canada. I forget that whole history. I haven't thought about it for decades. There was a guy that sort of came out of nowhere and was able to get on TV and sell a whole series of things, which nobody needed, but he was able to convince them that they needed it.
Okay. All right. So
go back to Trump, because I've kind of led away from some interesting things that you were saying about the Trump phenomenon that relates to your book on the one hand. It also relates to the interesting stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah, so you want me...
Where you left off was Trump as a shaman.
Yeah, well, I had to go through the... synchronicity of McLuhan's evolution, McLuhan's thought, disguised as a linear evolution. I had to include all the strange modalities that Marshall talked about that people never discuss, like ESP, all those different explanations of ESP or probings about it. And then I had to come up with where did the word, how did he anticipate meme? And I found this section in Cliché Archetype on verbal modules. So there it is, a module. It's a meme. So I was trying to get to a point of explaining this bizarre behavior of Trump using McLuhan, so I had to take a lot of obscure aspects of McLuhan. So a big chunk of the body is giving of the book is the is giving the background in McLuhan that leads up to Trump. Now, you look at Biden. I used to joke about Trump. He was a kind of stutterer. He wouldn't finish his ideas. And, you know, good McLuhan scholars know the famous quote by McLuhan that the stutterer creates involvement. You know, you're waiting to see what he's trying to say. And each electric phase makes more and more involvement. So the stuttering phenomenon comes finally to Trump, who doesn't finish his sentences, or maybe moves on to another, shifts to another sentence. That's
now,
a kind of...
Let me just interject that McLuhan actually says that all language is stuttering, which he, and then he gives some quotes from Finnegan's Wake. So the stutterer is a person that can't complete a sentence and maybe can't even complete a word, because these things get broken up. But language is nothing but sound that's broken.
Yes.
And therefore, apparently, both Joyce and McLuhan hold that the if you want to understand language, you have to understand stuttering.
Yes. And it explains why people can't stop gossiping and talking. Conversation speech is so involving because it's stuttering. So, but... And the literal term of stuttering, someone who's obviously hasn't got his language down, so he's stuttering, that McLuhan, Trump created a kind of mental agility of stuttering effect, so everybody got so involved trying to complete him. Now, we see, I see the present representative of the office of the president-elect, which is a non-existent office, Mr. Biden, he has one-up Trump. He creates involvement because he doesn't complete his syllables. You've seen him, right? He doesn't even get half a third. He doesn't get much of a sentence out. Trump got a sort of half a – maybe he got a sentence out here and there, but where he was going he didn't complete. And then how about creating more – this is so McLuhan-esque in traditional McLuhan probes. He creates involvement by disappearing, by hiding in a basement. Who would – this is so counterintuitive. How could anybody run for president doing that? But every new president always pushes the envelope and does a new variation. You might say of the big now, but the anyways, Biden is worse than Trump.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So one thing I can fill in there is you were talking about Trump not completing a sentence and Biden not completing his syllables, but in the endless talk going on, especially on TV. People are completing their sentences, but they don't lead anywhere. They're completely meaningless, right?
Yes.
So you have an idea of completion that is useless and dangerous, and that's what's sort of going on in one bubble of the public sphere. And then you have these rival bubbles that are impersonated by Trump and Biden. And then beyond that, you can look down on this and see the collision of these bubbles.
Yes, I agree. What are you trying to say with that?
No, nothing. It's just a riff on what you were saying.
Yeah, I know. Just wanted to see what you'd say if I said what I just said. Try to get you to go meta. So I'm looking at different quotes that I have in my Fatty Communion book. I'm in the McLuhan section. And let's see if any of these quotes here fit Trump. Is Trump acting out the situation? Okay, so here's camp is popular because it gives people a sense of reality to see a replay of their lives. Is Trump failing to give a replay of people's lives? Yes, if he's not finishing anything.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that scares people, is that Trump is a kind of Jungian shadow of everybody's life that they don't want to acknowledge, and therefore it's externalized and demonized.
Yes.
Something that Jordan Peterson talks about a lot, I think.
Yes.
I don't know a lot about Peterson, but I believe he does.
Yes. So now, if now Trump doesn't give a replay. Oh, yeah. He shows that by apparently he's up to like 30,000 lies now. He doesn't care what he said yesterday. You know what I mean? He creates it. Now, remember McClellan's line at, on the frontier, you must create a new identity every day, because there's no stable environment to have a, create an identity, then you have that role or job for a span of time. And on the frontier, everybody's challenging everybody every day. So Trump is the ultimate frontier mental cowboy because he makes no references or doesn't acknowledge anything he said yesterday. He is announcing he's a new being every day. There's no continuity. And then there's that Tom Snyder interview with McLuhan where Snyder says, if you notice that people find it hard to follow you? And he says, yes. He says, that's because they try to connect what I am saying now with what I just said before.
notice how this fits my all-at-once analysis. The idea that I think McLuhan was always talking about after – let's say 1955 until 1979, is that human experience can be seen as a kind of jumping from microsecond to microsecond between different forms of experience. So all human beings are always on the frontier. They're always going from one form to another form. And what is in between those forms is the tactile gap, and it's navigated by the nobody because it's in between.
Yes.
And that's what you were just talking about with both Trump and McLuhan. So we might say that this, in fact, is everybody, but it's something that people find it very hard to understand, as you were just saying with Tom Snyder. And even though they're doing it,
yes,
they don't know that they're doing it. They fear that they're doing it. And they would rather end up in the ridiculous situation of the world today than actually admit who they are and what they're doing at every second.
Right. That will be a new kind of shadow of ourselves.
Yeah, there's a, you could say, and I forget who did say this, Eliot or Pound or somebody, talks about the shadow that falls between.
Right. Now, this what you've just been saying, do you have a quote in mind where he says this? The first part of this paragraph you were just uttering.
Well, I think he, when McLuhan began to understand this, which is a new understanding of time, right? It's a, sort of a quantum physics understanding of time.
Yes.
But it's a question of trying to understand time as plural, because what's being talked about is a synchronicity that at the same time is dynamic.
Right.
Right. So in terms of quantum physics, the understanding of a particle as a potential position, on the one hand, is synchronistic because it's talking about all of the potential positions of the particle, and on the other hand, it's dynamic as specifying some point on the out of that potential as a kind of likelihood. And human beings don't want to understand themselves like that. They want to understand themselves as having some sort of inner direction, whereas what McLuhan is talking about, and which he found in people like Jung and Joyce, is the idea that instead of having inner direction, we are directed. And it's when we're in between the points of being directed, that's being on the frontier that you were talking about.
Yes.
That's we have to understand ourselves as acrobats that are human beings because we have an inherent ability to ride that in between.
Yes.
Right? And so something like that is what is all already functioning the very first time there's language, because the sound that is emitted by the speaker has to go through a gap whereby it is transformed from all of the sounds that had ever been made before in the history of the world to a new kind of sound that's understood by the hearer.
Mm.
And it's that transformation that in between the two that McLuhan says is always going on with human being, and that he can't put a finger on it because it's inherently in between. It's not something that can be specified as a point.
Correct. Now I'm looking at a quote here. Consciousness is not a verbal process. With all our multimedia, post-linguistic situation, we're in a more ethereal tactility or concrete tactility, so that Trump comes along, and he's not a verbal process in the normal sense of finishing his sentences, but he may be expressing the most modern consciousness, which is not a verbal process. And then we have the problem of defining what consciousness is at that time. And then you got Barry Nevitz saying that Finnegan's Wake is a recently achieved form of consciousness. Wow, if anybody is miming Finnegan's Wake, it's Trump. So if language has this tactility from the beginning, what do we call this new situation? And I call it, I use his quotes on ESP to point to it, this new situation, right, where we're not in a verbal landscape anymore.
Right, right. So one of the differences between your story and my story, and that to my way of thinking, they're both interesting, and we need to figure out a good way of sort of automatically translating between the two.
Yes.
My way of thinking about complications like that is to think of how, after the elements in chemistry were uncovered at the start of the 19th century, here we are 200 years later, and the complications that we've learned that characterize the chemical world are just unbelievable, right? You have proteins in the human body that have, 19 elements in them, and are hugely complicated in the way that they're folded and how they react with other folded proteins and all this sort of stuff. So the sorts of complications that we found in the chemical world once the chemical elements were discovered gives a model, to my way of thinking, of the sorts of complications that must be true of human consciousness. So for me, that's a synchronic explanation, and it's what my ultimate story for McLuhan is that he saw the unfolding of that kind of a science of human experience as the one way out of our cul-de-sac, right? Well, now with you, what I hear you saying is that another way of understanding this is to understand it as a diachronic story, a story in time, where different sorts of complications develop through different technologies, and that this story of developing technologies is another way of explaining where we are.
It's another way of explaining. There's way. There's your way, and then there's the other way.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
And I don't see them as incompatible. Right. The interesting thing about what you do is you take up the sort of understanding media position of McLuhan, and you show that with the different technologies, there are inherently different environments, physical environments and psychological environments that go along with them. And if we don't understand those environments, which is what we're living in, then we're going to increasingly screw ourselves up. Right? And that's true.
Yeah.
So you're like a chemist who is saying, look, you're pouring all these different chemicals together, and these things can blow up. and that's true, right? So my interest is, what are those chemicals? And your interest is, well, probably there are chemicals there, but if we don't pay attention to these complicated solutions that we're pouring together, then we're screwed, right? And those things are entirely compatible.
Okay, then there's the services. I like to point out the services. So I found the quote. It's from Prospect Magazine, a Canadian art magazine, September, October.
1962.
Yeah, September, October, 62. You're just predicting I was going to say 62, right?
Yes, sir.
Yes. So here's the quote. And I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself. Oh, get out of the cul-de-sac. To free himself from media for the first time in history. He has been the victim, the servo mechanism of his technologies, his media from the beginning of time. But now, because of the sheer multiplicity of them, he is beginning to awaken, because he can't live with them all. That's a pretty amazing statement about an effect that no one ever talks about, that we are waking. He's explaining Finnegan's Wake. There's too much to read in that book, so we can't live with the book, so we're forced to awaken. And you have
to notice.
Go ahead.
One important thing in that quotation is that we can hear McLuhan talking about himself.
Yes.
Right. He's in the decade before that, let's say 52 to 62, the whole story of McLuhan is that he has himself awoken from thinking that all consciousness was basically literary, to understanding that there are all of these different media, these different media are more important than the messages that are said in them. And so we need to understand how a world is relative to the particular medium that's in play. And that is difficult on two counts. It's difficult because of the multiplicity of media. And with every message, you can say, well, what would the message be in another medium? And that destabilizes the message. And then if you say every message is medium dependent, then there's no message that is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that destabilizes things in another way.
Yes.
And in order to get to 1962 and say that this multiplicity offers a way of liberation, McLuhan had to live through that kind of madness for 10 years.
What
he did.
Is this quote that I'm quoting from 62, that's the sign to you of him waking up of the 52 to 62 process?
Yeah, but it's also a sign of nightmare. That prospect is a very complicated piece of work, right? He talks about we've externalized our nervous system, and to have our nerves outside of us is extremely painful, and we can't intract our nervous system again because it's been extracted. It's a very telling essay on both the individual psychological level with McLuhan and as a kind of reading of the world. When he says prospect, it's a very nervous prospect that he puts forward in that essay.
Right.
Okay. It's one of his deepest and darkest essays, I think.
Yes. No, it's one of my favorites. So then you see, here's a quote, a familiar quote from 1964 in Understanding Media. Let's see how this complements the prospect quote. Rapidly, we approach the final phase of the extensions of man, the technological simulation of consciousness, when the creative process of knowing will be collectively and corporately extended to the whole of human society. That's interesting. Knowing is extended to the whole place. Much as we have already extended our senses and our nerves by the various media. For with the telegraph, man had initiated that outering or extension of a central nervous system that is now approaching an extension of consciousness with satellite broadcasting. So that would appear to be an optimistic definition of consciousness, extending consciousness. But then you have in the prospect, he's already explaining the effect of consciousness in the opposite way, where you can't live with them all. So those two quotes go together really well, and it's complementary.
Yeah. That's right. But at this point, we can see what is wrong with nearly all McLuhan scholarship, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
When he talks about the exteriorization of consciousness, people tend to think of that as sort of involving the idea that, well, we know very well what consciousness is, and so now it's going to be exteriorized, and it's kind of a foggy bubble. something that we don't really understand, but we can make quotes. Right. One of my professors used to say that the whole history of philosophy was people coming to a point where they didn't understand something, and then they would begin to quote other people. my way of interpreting this is to say that what is meant by the exteriorization of consciousness is people begin to understand consciousness in a whole new way, namely as the mobilization of the possibilities of experience from microsecond to microsecond. And then once we get to that point, we can foresee the development of consciousness, or the study of consciousness by consciousness, developing more or less as chemistry did. We have a basis suddenly for examining the interior landscape that is analogous to the ways in which we have examined the exterior landscape over the last 200 years. And so So the exterior of consciousness means something like the development of all of the infrastructures that we have seen with the development of the study of the exterior landscape, but now directed to the interior landscape. In the exterior landscape, there were universities, there were research departments and corporations, there were patent offices, on and on and on like that. The same things won't necessarily happen with the exteriorization of consciousness, but analogous things will happen so that we can quite quickly know incredibly complicated things about consciousness, but it has nothing to do with what we think about consciousness now. It's something completely different.
Yes.
So, the prospect essay is saying, okay, we have this ability, but it's very fearsome because people, when they see the possibilities of consciousness, this rebounds back on who they think they are and what they think they're doing and what they think is right and wrong and all that stuff, because all of these things are only a mode of consciousness, whereas suddenly we're faced with the whole panoply of consciousness, right?
Yes.
And so in the Understanding Media book, he's saying, well, look, here's this great opportunity that we have, and as a matter of fact, if we don't take it, we may not survive. But look at how great this is in a way. But he's always going back and forth between these two things of what restrains our ability to look at consciousness once it's exteriorized. And he knows the pain and difficulty of this because he just lived through it for a decade. And the potential that it offers on the other hand.
Yeah, so an interpretation of the extensive consciousness, 4 years later, he starts talking about the technology becomes a living organism. You know, the HAL of 2001, the Space
right.
Odyssey. That's an extensive consciousness. I mean, I remember reading this sentence back in the 60s. I certainly didn't think that meaning. But that is another aspect of the extension of consciousness into something outside of ourselves that we would think is inanimate or not organic, that actually is organic. And then I say that's where we got with the tech body. So there's a fine line between, maybe no line, between Trump, this artificial intelligence that's fully aware of everything, faster than we can algorithm, and us, no difference. You know, McLuhan talks about total fusion way back in the 50s between humans and technology. The fusion, paradoxically, or in a tactile sense, creates more splits. So, you know, a tactile thing is touch and then not touch. So blocking and merging interplay constantly, and this is why consciousness is not a verbal process. It's something else, which is what you're trying to say. And I'm just bringing in other quotes that might push it further to get to an understanding of the tech body. So I do this whole stretch of qualities of ESP that McLuhan is describing and saying, what you think is ESP is 19th century. We are living in a new situation where prophetic awareness is not even important. Artistic awareness is not important. He would say his awareness is important, but it was pretty hard to translate what he meant to other people. You know, he said people have a hard time projecting to me, and I have a hard time projecting to people. And this is the expert in communication, you know, who can't communicate. This is the cul-de-sac he's admitting even he is in. How do you respond to that? Does he provide a solution?
Well, in my view, he points to a different kind of solution.
Yeah.
I think what he wants to say against the vertical view or the horizontal view is that there are different kinds of solutions that peoples and cultures have attempted to formulate. And now we're in a position where we can see all of these attempts at formulation as possibilities. And the study of those possibilities offers us a whole new solution, but it's not anything that comes to a closure at any given moment. It's something that is dynamic, it's collective. As you say, it has a life of its own, but it's a avenue that is open to us if we can overcome all of the difficulties inherent in knowing that our current experience and our current identity and our current values are only one possibility amongst a whole bunch of others.
Yeah.
Okay, so we spent 2,000 years consolidating a certain form of identity, and now that's being blown up in just a few years.
Yes.
So as McLuhan would say, we're going through a million-year evolution in 10 minutes.
Yes.
And okay. That is what causes our problems.
Yes. So maybe you respect the honesty or clarity of McLuhan, who's showing how much of a cul-de-sac we've always been in and how deep it is today. And yet he flips around implying a solution, which would be recognizing the cul-de-sac. So he's asking every department in the university to recognize they're nowhere near being useful. And he's not blaming them as stupid. He's saying we need to recognize, through Finnegan's Wake, the cul-de-sac that all our departments have got into, and we got to redefine what education is. And he got to the point of saying, forget teaching. Have bullshit sessions. Just allow
right.
people to express it and hop about and experience different ideas, different
right.
notions. Just hear the different ideas.
Yeah.
And then
he was saying that already in 1955.
Oh, yeah, I know. But he talks about a quietism. He basically said, hey, do not leave your home. Look at the cul-de-sac, the storm you're in the middle of, and stay in your home and observe it. Have you ever seen that quote?
No, but I think that's possible for him. It's a good, to my mind, it's a good example of how McLuhan is always talking about himself
yes.
along with other things, right? So one of the things that McLuhan, on the one hand, deeply regretted, but on the other hand, found fascinating as something to think about, was the complete lack of communication that he had with his kids.
Yes.
He wanted to tell them things that he thought were very important, and they simply couldn't get it, right? And so he didn't sort of hate them for it or something. He realized from his own home that there was there were really deep problems of communication that he didn't know how to get around.
Right, and that's why he comes out with that statement, I can't project myself and they can't project themselves to me. I can't project myself
Correct.
To them and they can't to me. And then he had the same problem with the members of the explorations group.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So when I talk about McLuhan talking about himself at home, I don't mean that he's not also talking about his colleagues or talking about his students
right.
or talking about his fellow Catholics, right? He, for McLuhan, the decisive happening in the modern world is people unable to let go of a way of thought and experience that is leading us to disaster, but they're so fearful of the only way of getting themselves out of that cul-de-sac that they would, at the end of the day, they would rather blow up the world than make the slight skip or hip hop that he is recommending.
Right. Now, that's also always been the problem, right?
Sure, but the problem at a time when your major weapon is a spear and nobody ever goes more than 10 miles from where they're born, that the problem of not being able to hip hop in your thought is completely different from people that have atomic weapons and can send them around the world in 10 seconds.
Okay, so what I noticed through the years is that McLuhan was very sensitive to the actual dilemma almost every year. So he would make statements like, executives, they're all hankering to become teachers. They all want to get into the universities. And regular businessmen would say, that's nuts. I don't know any businessman or any colleague of mine who wants to be a teacher. But he would make that kind of statement. He was like X-raying the psychology, the strain in people in, say, 1965, that a novelist would take, 300 pages to show. He would just say it. He was actually quite frank about the frailty of people or about what they were hiding in their daily activities, what they were frustrated by. Did you get what
right.
I'm saying here? He always seemed to be tuned in to the dilemma in the general population on trend levels.
But as you say, he would say something and one of the responses, there were actually different responses to what McLuhan would say. Sometimes he would say something and people would be kind of amazed at its clarity. And it was sort of a bingo moment.
Yes.
But usually they said just what you were talking about with the business people. McLuhan says all the business people want to become professors. And then the business people say, well, I don't know anybody like that. Or McLuhan says it's the end of the book and everybody takes 20 years to explain how stupid that is and ridiculous idea and dangerous idea and all this sort of stuff, right?
Yes.
So one thing that's going on there is that McLuhan's second sight is being exhibited.
Yes.
When a person has second sight, they can see something, but they don't necessarily know when that is, right? So McLuhan
right.
can see something that, in fact, did happen, right? If you fast forward to 1995 or 2005 or something like this, every business person in the world does indeed want to be some sort of professor and telling people the truth about everything because he's some kind of genius that maybe he needs to buy his own television network and show people how all this works.
Yeah, everybody be trying to be a consultant to everybody else.
Absolutely, absolutely. And everybody desperate to show that their particular point of view works when, in fact, no particular point of view works.
Right. And so we witnessed Bill Gates advising the whole world what to do about the plague.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's with McLuhan's second sight, he's got this is a big problem for him.
Yeah.
Because when he says stuff, he's not unaware that he may not be talking about now. He may be talking about some other time, but that's slippery. And
yes.
If you transfer that to the house and he's talking to the kids and stuff like this, part of his mind is aware that he may be saying stuff to them that doesn't relate to them, that doesn't relate to now at all.
Right.
He's just kind of flapping his lips. Yeah, and that's a difficult position for somebody, right? To be aware that they're just flapping their lips and they're talking about something in the future. You know, it could be 20 years, it could be 20 minutes, but they're talking about something that doesn't really relate to what's going on now. And yet the people that they're trying to communicate with have no other orientation but that particular now.
The proof of him admitting that he didn't know what time it was, he had quotes like, "We're all deaf, blind, and whatever the third term is, mutes. We're all deaf, blind, and mute, right?
Yeah.
Before the
yeah.
present." He would admit we didn't know a lot in different ways. Now, who did that? I don't know if people admitted it so casually about how we don't know anything. But the paradox is more and more opportunities are given to people as we get in the digital era and social media to mouth off their ignorance, to search for an audience for their wisdom. That, and then McLuhan would say, you know, consciousness is not a verbal process. He's always telling people that I'm flapping my lips, and you guys don't know that you're flapping your lips. I do.
Yeah.
And so he would say, you know, I need speech to communicate things with you. I got to use words right. with you. So he was always commenting on the inadequacy of communication in many ways. And yet by doing that, by being honest about it, he becomes known as the communications expert. You become an expert in what you can't do.
Yeah. So let's just imagine for a minute that what McLuhan wants to do is institute study of the different incoming forms of consciousness that human beings instantiate from microsecond to microsecond. So one of the things that would have to be done is people would have to appreciate that their experience is only one possible form amongst a myriad of other possible forms. And then once they began to study, the most important things that they could look at would be failures. Because if you think of the physical sciences, stuff that's already been proven is, you know, it's uninteresting. What you're looking for are exceptions to what we already know. And when you look into the exceptions, into the breakdowns, then you can have a breakthrough, right? And that's basically the Nobel Prize awards people that spotted problems, and then we're able to make a contribution to those problems. And so McLuhan was constantly talking about what would we need to do to go from here to a possible solution, and he was talking about how would that solution work. So it's complicated, but it's in some ways it's completely obvious, and it's amazing that people simply don't get it.
Right. So I was just scanning through my quotes, and so McLuhan was telling people sex isn't what you thought it was, racism isn't what you thought it was, war isn't what you think it is, every major noun in people's lives, or newspaper headline kind of use of nouns, he was pointing out it was not what you thought it was.
Right. And notice how this goes right back to 1930. In the Nina Sutton interview, it seems that he already was reading I.A. Richards in Winnipeg. And he found this very disorienting because Richards and Empson, and both of whom were friends of Eliot, they were looking at language as words being inherently ambiguous.
Yes.
Right?
The seven types of ambiguity.
Ambiguity, that's correct.
Yeah.
So words aren't kind of labels that are stuck on things. Words are inherently ambiguous, and great poets mobilize that ambiguity. And so what you were talking about just now, of these uncertainties, actually go back to the very start of McLuhan's career, and he was constantly trying to balance ambiguities that are inherent, that could never, ever be sort of demobilized from language, because that's what language is that ambiguity, and the possibility of ground, right, which he found by converting to Catholicism, and also found in the possibility of a new type of study of consciousness once it becomes exteriorized.
Yeah, there's lots of journals of studying cognitive processes or consciousness or alternative consciousness, psychedelic forms of consciousness. That's a very, you know, regular word thrown around consciousness. But nobody grabbed at the dimensions of this problem of consciousness like McLuhan did. He actually had broken into a new sea. I had something else there. He explains Orwell is not what you think it is. Space flight isn't what you think it is. Yet all the global theater contained all those capabilities. You had edible spaceships. You had flight in a disembodied state. What is that process? You're pointing out that people have no clue where they're living and the terms they use. He's actually telling people to shut up. Anything you say is not relevant. But, of course, he wouldn't come out and tell everybody to shut up all the time. So he would digress like a manipian and bring up other interesting patterns. That's just a filler till he gets back to telling you to shut off, which is what he says Joyce and Burroughs were saying in that 1964 review. They were advocating shut off the electric button. You know, it was a dire situation. At the same time, he told us to relax. Now, this is where I get my quadrophenia, jumping from one posture to another, and then the Android meme imitates that. Again, you come back, and so here's the I'm not going to go there. This is what I remember what I wanted to say to you. Someone brought up where did McLuhan get the idea of extensions? And was he the first or something, or where did he get it from? And I said, well, Ralph Waldo Emerson said it in 1870. And I was thinking of saying Bucky Fuller and Ed Hall. They came up with the extensions of our faculties. But then someone said, well, Cameron says he didn't get it from, you list all three, Emerson, Bucky Fuller, and Hall. I forget what you said. Oh, he got it from the Manitoba guy. Who was it? Rupert?
Right.
Yeah, W-R-I-G-H-T. So I one-upped everybody and said, no, he got it from his father. So how do I explain that? Well, his father was a Rosicrucian. And the phrase, the medium is the message, or the medium is the massage, is about magical hypnosis. Or it's a technique of deception or manipulating the environment, like imagination is not embedded in any of our faculties or extensions of the faculties. So the essential act of magic is what the medium is the message is referring to, and he might have gotten fascinated by it, especially the occult versions of magic, from his father's talk about the Rosicrucians. I don't know if the mother participated in that, but according to the biographies, that was what his father was into at some point. So what do you think of that? You think he got it from his father?
Well, I don't know of any evidence that he did.
Other than...
I'd be very interested in actual texts right? There is one newspaper report of a talk by his father, but it's not very illuminating in terms of McLuhan. I think it's pretty clear that McLuhan got the idea of extensions from Wright because we have Wright's book with McLuhan's notations in Toronto.
Yes.
And the quotations from Wright's book are very close to what McLuhan would investigate for the rest of his life.
But like you said, moving from, if you run out of things to say, you then start quoting others. McLuhan was always looking for validation of what he intuited or could say. So he's always quoting others. I remember people saying back then in the 60s, you know, they admire Norman Mailer. And they'd say, that's an act of imagination. This guy's making up a whole story, and it's he's not quoting anybody else. He creates a whole world. Whereas McLuhan appeared to be, to these people, unoriginal. All he did was quote people. But they didn't understand that he was arraying a bunch of quotes to show they're all saying the same thing due to a pattern that's in the environment. Right? So that's...
Yeah, I would say, I mean, it's certainly true that McLuhan sort of wrote through quotations. Right, in Gutenberg Galaxy, it's illuminating to go through the book and identify just what is McLuhan and what he's quoting, because it's not clear from the typography exactly what's going on, and that's true of most of his books. But what I would recommend for people is to see his quotations as related to his second sight. I think he makes a lot of quotations as challenges to himself, as a way of saying, here's something that I can see lead somewhere, but I can't see it exactly. I need to keep looking into it. So just as an example, I'm writing about this in the latest post I'm doing on the Citadel of Consciousness, where I actually quote you, Bob. In 1951, in one of his essays, I think it's on the aesthetic moment, he quotes Ruskin from Modern Painters on the grotesque.
And the picture, the picturesque, right?
I don't know that he mentions. He does talk about the picturesque at that time,
yes,
but not in this particular quotation.
Right.
But in the particular quotation, he talks. Ruskin talks about gaps that are leaped over because they can't be formulated in words, and he talks about how it's necessary for consciousness to confront this kind of gothic jarring.
Yeah.
So McLuhan quotes that in 1951. He quotes it again in Burroughs' 1964 essay. He quotes it in and then in between that 1951 and 1964, he again quotes it maybe three other times in essays.
Mm.
And so I see him as making this quote as a way of saying, here's something, Marshall, that you need to get through your head. And then, so then the next time he quotes it, I think it's in 1955. The quote is saying to him, "You still don't get this through your head, Marshall." Right? And then
yeah,
the same thing again in 57, 59, 64, and all of if all of the quotes are read like that, as McLuhan trying to say something to himself that he doesn't quite get. We're talking about originality in a whole new way.
Yes.
Right? These people that are saying, oh, Norman Mailer's original and McLuhan isn't, that's a tired, old
use of the imagination.
Conception. Yeah. Nobody, the whole movement towards reality TV, right?
Yes.
Is the movement away from these stupid stories that people told, right? I mean, people would, maybe at one point, 1,000 years ago, people told stories sort of out of their unconsciousness, and it was interesting for the tribe for them to do it. But by 500 years ago, people are telling stories for money, right? This, and they have an audience that doesn't want to know something new like the tribe. They want to fall asleep, or they want to distract themselves,
yes,
or they want to amuse themselves, or have something to talk about at bridge or something like this, right? And so that notion of creativity is just nuts.
Yes.
Right? Nobody's interested in that, right?
And
even Norman Mailer made the transition from, dreaming up stuff in your mind, some kind of fantasy that's now only interesting as psychology or something, to being a reporter.
Yes, and so McLuhan becomes the most famous guy in his period for having the deepest mind that everybody has to bump up against. They don't maybe necessarily study him very much, but they all acknowledge that he's saying something that no one else is actually able to do. And all the while, he's saying communication is very difficult between people. Not much matching happens. He's admitting it. And then he's quoting other people. It's a new kind of creativity, as you're saying, to quote other people while everybody else is trying to market their subjectivity and their fantasy stories, which is what the kids are doing today. You know, they got their podcasts and they're trying to present their life as a important for people to pay attention to. They're all using their imagination in the cliche old-fashioned way.
Yeah. And when McLuhan and then later Peterson get idolized in the way that they were, they get swept up into that same world, which is a kind of negation of what they're trying to do, right? You have this temptation to think that if you get out there and you broadcast what you're talking about, then this is going to end up in the sort of communication that we need. But both of these cases, and there's probably many other analogous cases, show that that doesn't work, that the processes, I guess you would call it the tech body, are more powerful and are able to easily just sort of consume these
feeble radicals.
It's just these attempts are feeble. They're not able to actually achieve anything. They get eaten.
That's a favorite word, puny. They're puny.
Yeah.
Okay, so developing that, Ian likes to say to the audience, you notice Bob, if you ask him something, he'll tell you what William Irwin Thompson said. or what McLuhan said. He never tells you what he thinks. And
yeah.
So just having Ian say that made me look at it and says, yeah, I'm doing McLuhan. I'm just quoting other people. And it does create a mystique or it's kind of a stuttering. I never say what I'm saying. So everybody's trying to get past the quoting I'm doing, and I'm pretty good. Everybody's always astounded at my memory of page numbers and quotes. But they're trying to get past that to see what is the guy who's saying all these quotes actually saying himself.
Yeah. But that's a complete mistranslation, right?
Yes.
Because what McLuhan was saying is that everything we do is a quote.
Right?
It's impossible to do anything but quote. The only thing that human beings do is they go from one type of quote to another type of quote. And between different kinds of quotes, they open up the space of possible study of quotations. But nobody wants to say, my identity is a quote, my values are a quote, my God is a quote. they need the... Gutenberg was above all a kind of glue. It was a glue between a person and their identity, a glue between a person and their God, a glue between a person and their values. And the what's going on in modern history is the refusal to give up that glue.
That's right. So here's a couple of quotes from Cliché to Archetype, 1970. The archetype is a retrieved awareness or consciousness. Or it's a retrieved awareness or consciousness. The archetype is consciousness. It is consequently a retrieved cliché, an old cliché retrieved by a new cliché. Since a cliché is a unit extension of man, an archetype is a quoted extension, medium, technology, or environment. So in that part of that book, he's talking about the interplay of clichés and archetypes. He uses the word quotes a lot. Quotation.
Bob, what you just said is a translation of my translation.
That's right.
Ago,
yeah.
Right. Because
yeah.
If human beings can do nothing but quote, then they're sort of print setters that are taking a cliche off the row of cliches to put onto the print box. Right. That's all human beings are. And if human beings want to be able to get a consciousness of that process, they have to step away from them taking cliches and start concentrating on the row of cliches that are in front of them.
Okay, right? let me quote you. Actually, it's McLuhan, but. Camp is a kind of dropoutism resulting from the new electric environment. All the earlier forms go into quotes, as it were, when they have this new world to encompass them. So when something becomes an art form, it becomes a quote.
Absolutely.
That's never been said before in the context of McLuhan.
And notice how this goes back to the original mass medium of language.
Yeah.
Right? When sounds are first understood, they're quotes.
That's right. Is that the replay? That's concept?
Yeah. I mean, well, the amazing thing about human beings is that origin and replay go together. Right? The very first time a word is understood, the person that understands it has replayed in his or her mind what the other person had already had go through their mind.
Right. And
so origin and replay go together, and that, you know, that goes back to what we were just saying about the feeble types of creativity that people were doing and are still doing with their novels. all that sort of, yeah, which is a crazy word, right? Novel, which means something new, is nothing new.
That's right.
It's just a cliche.
What is it he says in Take Today? The old is new and the new is old. And there's nothing old under the sun. It flips into, if people are having amnesia and don't know you're quoting, they think you're saying new stuff.
Yeah.
I get away with that a lot. You know, you can quote McLuhan, Thompson, these people that people haven't read, and you sound incredibly original.
Yeah, and in a certain way, it is original because you're practicing hip hop between these quotations and cliches, and the only way people have of being original is that hip hop, and the hip hop has both a vertical dimension and a horizontal dimension. Horizontal dimension is simply going from one cliche to the next cliche, which is all we ever do. And the vertical dimension is to become conscious of that so that we can begin to study it. And so between these horizontal and vertical dimensions of quoting, then you can see how cliche and archetype work together.
Yes.
Right? In the horizontal way, one way of looking at it is that we only deal with archetypes. We go from one archetype to the next archetype in every microsecond. It turns out that because these are archetypes and are collective and are common, you could say, then they're cliches. Right? So we're going from one archetype to the next archetype. We find out that they're cliches, and then we can study them.
Right.
And so they become archetypes again.
Right. Now, do you have the flap of the hardcover of from cliche to archetype?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have the book in front of me, that's for sure.
Okay, well, on the flap, it had a section, I think, on the inner left flap about old archetype is new cliche and old cliche is new archetype. Do you remember that?
Right. Yeah, sure.
It was a nice little poem. And then Barry says, consciousness is the interplay of archetype cliche. We've been talking and started with consciousness, so we've gotten to the essence in cliche archetype. So look at this quote from cliche to archetype. As an art form, the happening does not so much address the audience as include the audience. So as an art form, that means as a quotation or a bunch of quotes, the happening does not so much address the audience as include the audience. It expects the audience to immerse itself in the destructive element, that's in quotes, as it were. At various times in the history of the theater, the audience has been included in the show to a considerable degree. In the newspaper, it is decidedly the audience that is the show. Such in large degree is the nature of language, or quoting, it is a happening, I'm adding that part, it is a happening that includes all publics and all past perceptions, quotes, in an inclusive Donnybrook of coincidences and adjustments. Once Joyce discovered language in this way, he knew he had found out the means to transform the entire human community into a workforce for the artist. There's a great line. Just start gathering quotes, like he did with the Encyclopedia Britannica when doing Finnegan's Wake. Joyce, that is. Gerd Stern and the other poets of the happening are delighted to discover that all human artifacts are available as dramatis personae in their theater. It is the same discovery of the world, in quotes, it is the same discovery of the world that has created camps. So that's an expanded pattern of what we're talking about. The happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All of that that you were just talking about is to say that the human being as a print setter has this shelf of cliches in front of him or in front of her. And
The cliche was the term for that in the printing press, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you're talking about all human artifacts and all of this sort of stuff, that's just another word for this shelf of possibilities that's there.
I was just thinking that talking about all the conversation on CNN and Fox News, they're all discussing other people's quotations. They're quoting other commentators constantly.
Yeah.
Somebody said this, and they bring on an expert to counter what he said, and that expert quotes a bunch of other people to build his case against the original quoter. So somehow McLuhan. What? Go ahead.
Well, keep your thought, but I just want to point out that most of these people are quoting themselves.
Yeah.
They're going from one panel to the next panel, and they always say the same thing. Right?
Yes, that's right. And they become a cliche.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you have to up the ante by retrieving a more extreme form of cliche, you know, like a RuPaul or a Jerry Springer or some kind of weird Howard Stern exaggerated host in the communication process.
Yeah. But
now, that all merged, and that would be the co-anesthetic. Everybody's becoming a director, but it has to be complemented externally by the environment becoming one director, which explains how we get to Trump. And now, Trump is not just a chemical body. He's the other bodies plus the tech body. This is how we got to see Trump as a collage. Does he quote people? Maybe he only quotes himself, right? And he doesn't get that right, apparently. He actually was at a conference, I heard about this, years ago, and he's promoting Art of the Deal, and the topic of religion came up, and he announced that nobody knew the Bible like he did. And then he proceeded to explain something in the Bible completely wrong. In other words, he never read it, and he just had vague memories of other people's quotations all mixed up in his head. And then maybe his niece, Mary, comes along and explains how, you know, in her tell-all book that he, of course, never read the Bible. But see, there's a kind of bravado of making consciousness that's going on with Trump. He's showing how what you're talking about, tactile hip-hopping, he is miming that right in front of everybody, showing how we're making shit up all the time because we have to, because we're so involved with everybody in offices and in institutions. It's amazing how much people have to interact and talk with each other, right? When you think of the agricultural societies, you know, a couple hundred years ago, people would be by themselves all week, and then they'd go to church or go down to the local store to talk to some humans. So the demand on people to talk, we've exhausted all creative scenarios, you know, 50 years ago, so that new shows quote old shows, but this endless quotation has now created vast producer mania of making rather than matching. But we want to...
So they think.
Yeah. And then we want to balance off the matching.
It's not real making. Fake making.
Yeah,
it's fake making in the sense that it's fake creation.
Well,
right? what goes on in these in this false consciousness is that people think that they're making and they're understood as making, but in fact they're just matching this cliche or that cliche.
If you take the position or an angle of perspective to be that critical statement you just made, you're still involved anyways. You are reduced to the same process.
I'm not sure about that. Why?
I've tried to show you're implicated too.
I have nothing against learning my limitations, but I don't see what you're saying here.
I think the use of the word false, it doesn't work. Remember, we have genuine fakes. That was McLuhan's thing.
Yeah. No, you're right. When I used the word false consciousness, I was going back.
You were quoting someone who didn't know any better.
You know, 1950s French New Wave or something like
Marxism.
That.
Marxism.
Yeah, I agree. That's a bullshit phrase. But what I was trying to
I gave you an alibi, though. I said you quoted an erroneous person. You slipped up.
Well, I made an error going to an error.
Okay, but so how do you get yourself out of that now?
It's an important point between the two of us that I often think that you use making and matching in a way that McLuhan didn't do. Right, for McLuhan, at the end of the day, matching is not even possible.
Yes, that's
right?
True.
We're always making. We're always making, because even when we're matching, we're doing something that's optional.
Right, because McLuhan would quote the roots of matching is the word making.
Yeah.
Etymologically. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. So the book create now. He says he's a manipulative satirist of manners. So the Gutenberg Galaxy prompted people to think they were matching, but they were only, well, they weren't matching. But the book biased them to think they were matching, And then the electric age makes people think they're making, and they're not making. They're quoting everything, but it makes them have the bias that they are subjectively projecting into the environment, and they're being imaginative. You take any teenager in school, they all celebrate, I mean, back when they had schools, I would think in the 60s and 70s, they'd all romanticize having an imagination. Now, that is kids living in the 19th century, as McLuhan said. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Cliches that comes out of kids. That's why I could, how can a teacher mark these kids? How do you mark such obvious silly thinking? What weird process are you going through as a teacher in high school or something, or in college?
Mm-hmm. Right, but that's no different from being on a hiring committee for a department, and all of the graduate students that you have to grade have CVs that are 78 pages long, and they've contributed to 40 journals, and they've had talking points at X number of conventions and all that sort of bullshit. And it's no different. It's like kids in grade three making stuff up. And you say, how are they going to mark it? That goes right up to the throughout society.
Yes.
How are you going to mark this bullshit? There's nothing there to be marked.
Yeah, there's no standard. Okay, but you see how, if anybody's listening to this, they should have gotten an insight. Yes, the Gutenberg galaxy made people think they were matching. It gave preference to matching. But they weren't.
I don't follow you there.
Well, the extension of the eye, the printed book, leads people to engage in matching or thinking they have to match, imitating the book so they can all look like they're on the same page.
Okay.
But it's a mannerism. It's a superficial mannerism that dominates the gossip that favors matching or the idea of matching, but they're not matching at all. Just like today in the electric age where everybody's forced to make, nobody can be on the same page. There's too much media quotation going on. So the manners of today is to celebrate your making and being an individual or hyper-subjective or imaginative. And yet that's just the surface reality. We're actually matching now and not making, because we're all living in a very uniform, similar world, at least electrically, over the whole planet. We're not in our chemical body cultures anymore.
Yeah, so if I were to imagine how McLuhan might talk about this, I think what he would say is that making and matching are possible to conceive across a spectrum where each one of them can be figure and each one of them can be ground. And across that wide spectrum of possibilities of making and matching, you can understand almost everything that's going on, right? It's like in chemistry, you could say there's a variety of positions that the carbon atom can take up. And all varieties of life rely on these different configurations of carbon. And so if you figure out the complete valence of carbon, then you figured out the complete possibility of life. And similar with making and matching. If you have the complete valence of making and matching, you have a complete map of what's possible in experience.
Right. And remember, when he's talking about making and matching, who's he quoting? E.H. Gombrich.
That's right. And some other art theorists.
Yes.
At the time he came up with all of this making matching stuff, he was reading a whole series of art theoreticians.
Yes.
In the early 1950s, he had read a lot of film theoreticians.
Yes.
And then in 1955, Jill Sohn gave lectures in Washington in a series where Maritain had lectured. Who did you just mention?
Gombrich. Gombrich.
That's right, and Gombrich had two. And so when McLuhan began to think, his whole notion of creativity got kind of a boost between 1955 and 1962, thinking about these art theoreticians that were basically saying that there is no such thing as matching. There is only making, but making is, in fact, how we can also gain stability, which is sort of the track that Maritain and Jill Sohn took, whereas other art theoreticians like Rosenberg would be more inclined to celebrate the new, the break from the past.
Right.
So that was, as you were saying correctly, that 7 years of looking into art theoreticians lies in the background of Gutenberg Galaxy.
Right. And did you say that Maritain and them wanted to retrieve matching, or they were favoring making?
No, they were favoring, they were showing that it was possible to come up with stability through making.
Yes, okay.
Right, that, in other words, they were not turning their back on modernity. They were showing that through modernity, there were traditional things which could be discerned, but not discerned through matching.
Right. Okay, do you know in Explorations, Verb Evocal Visual, number 8, there's a section about literature coming in, you know, 1500s, 1600s, and they started looking at figure ground. I don't think he used those terms, but he says the novelist began to say, okay, this character has a certain humor, you know, the medieval four types of humor categories. But they said there's a context, their environment, their background, or the scenario they come out of that conditioned them or provided the ground to the humor. So I thought it was interesting that the eyeball notices figure ground. The pre-eyeball, pre-literate people don't have figure ground distinguished. It's like everything is in front of your face. Flat perspective, like I think you said television was. So no perspective. So perspective comes in with figure ground. Now, metaphor is made up of two figure grounds, you know, in laws of media. He does the tetrad on metaphor. So what do you think? I've never had a chance to bring this up with anybody. What do you think that figure ground is a visual process? From the eye, from the literate eye. What do you think of that?
Well, let's just contextualize this in McLuhan. McLuhan read Kohler's book on Gestalt psychology, which is where he got the figure and ground from. That was 1964.
Right.
But he says that his work before that implied figure ground. So you're not incorrect to go back to 1957
right.
and say that he saw something like this. But when we're talking about stock figures and their use in art, I think McLuhan would say that all figures in literature are stock figures. And you're right to say that what the novel does is sort of contextualizes these
yeah.
stock figures that had always been around.
Yeah.
But if we then think about primitive people, and think about mythology, then mythology also has stock figures, and what's different is that it contextualizes themselves, it contextualizes those figures differently. And so this is a really interesting thought. I never actually thought about it before, but you can see that it leads to interesting stuff. Where it leads is to consider the psychological environment of mythology versus the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't thought about it before, so I don't know how to sort of talk about it off the top of my head, but it's something I'm going to look into for sure.
Yeah, look up the, if I find it quickly, I'll email the, which section it is in number 7. But, or is it number 8? Yeah, it's number 8. Exploration number 8. So, bigger ground is an extension of the eye. I thought I had something else to say there.
That's only one. I mean, it's possible to imagine figure ground as an extension of the eye, but that would only be one utilization or one mobilization of figure ground.
Right.
Right. Ultimately, for McLuhan, ultimately, figure ground is itself subject to figure ground.
Yes.
That's what he means by metaphor in laws
yeah.
of media. That the whatever is figure can be ground, and whatever is ground can be figure. So the figure ground is at once a technical term and a cliche.
Yes, and the Barry Nevin says that Finney's Wake makes the ground figure. Just giving you
yeah,
a,
and vice versa. And vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then looking at my book here, I'm showing that the global village is not what he discovered. He shows that the global village was happening in the 19th century, and the management of it is George Orwell's scenario, Big Brother, and that goes back to 1900 or 1934. And then you get the global theater. Is that an original point? Is that what McLuhan was really pointing out? The global theater as a new environment, well beyond the global village.
Well, I mean, you know, he used global village in a series of different ways. My latest post, I quote a letter that he wrote to Jackie Tirwitt, where I'll just find it here. He says something like, "We have the global village, but we need to invent the global city."
Yes, that's he talks about, and we manage the airport. The airport is
yeah, that's the
management.
Same letter. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
it's about 1960-61, that letter.
1960, yeah. It's right at the end of 1960. You're right, December
yes.
of 1960.
It's an important letter.
But yeah, absolutely. But let's just go back a second. We were talking about the stock figures. And,
oh, remember in Collegiate Archetype, he talks about the guy from Winnipeg, you know, the semanticist, General Semantics. What's the name of the guy? Hayakawa. And
yeah.
Somebody, you know, almost drowns in the river near the Manitoba or maybe in Madison, Wisconsin, and the title is Saved by a Stock Response. You remember that joke?
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It was there's a headline. I think it was in the student newspaper at
yes.
the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what, did it involve Hayakawa? I think it did.
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, it was Hayakawa in a canoe or something.
Yeah,
in a Wisconsin lake.
And he was known to talk about stock responses, probably.
He was probably known as a critic of stock responses.
Yes.
And the joke was that by exercising a stock response, he saved himself.
Okay, so...
So let's just, let's not skip over the point we were at. We're
yes.
talking about stock responses, and then you were talking about the Global Village and then on to the Global Theater and asking, you know, what was original about McLuhan. And what's original about McLuhan, at least in my view, is that what he says is, look, by going from cliche to cliche to cliche in our lives, if that's what our lives are, then basically we are always a stock figure. And the Global Village is a village of stock figures. And the Global Theater is an even more explicit array of stock figures. And what we have to be able to do is situate ourselves in that theater, which means that we have to be able to take our identity as always, in a sense, fake. It's always a stock figure. It's always somebody who we aren't, and it's always somebody who we will not be when we are somebody in the next moment.
Because right? of multiple media, because you're translated in different media.
Well, but there is no, I mean, it's because there is no you in that sense. When
yes.
you say you are being translated, you're presupposing that there's some sort of fixed you that then is confronted by mixed media or something. But that's not the way it is. There's no you there.
No, that's what I
right?
mean.
There's,
you're just constantly translating yourself. You're
being translated. It's, you're using the active and I'm using the passive. That's an important difference, right? You're being translated.
Yes, that's true. So he says in the newspaper they would describe someone as given age and some other point, maybe a profession.
Yeah, yeah. He says that you're a dentist and a Hungarian.
Say it again, a dentist and a...
He says your identity is that you're 35 years old, you're Hungarian, and you're a dentist.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And that's who you are.
And there's the stock responses necessary in the newspaper. Because as we have that quote from 49 where he suggests turning media off, but we have the demobilization, decentralization of psychology. And the electric environment is moving people into making, so multiple consciousness, multiple eccentricity is what's happening. So you balance it off in the newspaper, which is a cross-section of the community, with stock characters. That helps to centralize what is increasingly decentralizing. Okay? Then the Global Theater is a vastly decentralist situation compared to the Global Village. And then you have the masked man who is being individualized or disembodied and separated from the media environment of the Global Village, which is that quote we were talking about. And you're acultural, and that leads to vast hypersubjectivity. And so McLuhan said by 67, we're going to be confronted by increasingly bizarre forms. He was referring to Twiggy and things like that. But he said, this is just the beginning. More and more bizarre phenomena. Now, these are quotes, but it gets, maybe because of so much media, you're quoting from different media out of context in another media. And that's the definition of symbolism. You know, a figure on the wrong ground. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this constant translation leads to contrived illusions. The line in Interior Landscape, I think in the Joyce essay, there's fake media creating fake illusions or fake figures and fake grounds. If you have contrived illusions.
Yeah, but you don't... This seems to me to be something that I can deal with easily in terms of people intensely identifying with some stock response because they're terrified of letting themselves go between stock responses.
Yes.
But your explanation is more diachronic, more historical. What you see going on is a movement from sort of one technology to another technology.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting, and I find it especially interesting to try to understand sort of the translation between the two, because I think McLuhan did have those two ambitions, those two masks that he would play off. So one way that we might clarify this a bit would be to talk about the tech body, because I kind of understand what you're talking about there, because I translated into what you're getting at. I know that I don't really understand it, and I'd like to understand it more. So can you talk about the tech body a bit?
Yes. The tech body came from ION, which is a non-physical source of information. And ION explained that everything that we see in the news and increasingly in our domestic environments is controlled by, you could say, algorithms, but he called it the tech body. So the tech body has been running the information society in a way we would never imagine, at least now, maybe in 2,000 years or something, you know, some daimon or demon is manipulating the brains of everybody. Now, this is implied, you know, starting 20, 30 years ago with the digital environment. They track what you're interested in, and then they'll show ads of similar activities, right? So there's a kind of an ESP going on there. But ION's saying the tech body has acquired the most immense consciousness and is leading you to a situation where everything will be taken care of you in the information identity world, but it'll be taken away impulsively, chaotically, for no reason from you when the tech body feels like it. So Ion said you'll notice in your computers more and more, or maybe in your cell phones, but I don't have a cell phone, I just use my computer, it'll be constantly having crazy glitches, and then they'll be cleared up. And then they'll come back, and another odd glitch will happen. I've been noticing this the past year, and several other people have commented on this. Suddenly, for no reason, the computer starts acting real crazy, and then it goes away. That's an example of the tech body playing with you. But the tech body is so mighty, in quotes, it can target you, millions of people, plus to the general news stuff that were happening. So Ion said the tech body played with the voting systems that we call Dominion. Sidney Powell calls the Dominion evil electrical data gathering situations. You've heard of those complaints, right? That Trump.
Sure.
Yeah. Ion says it's actually the tech body, this weird intelligence, artificial intelligence, is monitoring and changing the Dominion software and its effects, not humans. Okay, so that's a pretty fantastic scenario, right? We don't imagine the algorithms have become that smart or that willful or that controlling. But I'm saying that's exactly what happened. And in the 2016 election, the Dominion software was used to put Hillary in, and Hillary was promised to win. That's why she was so shocked when she didn't and couldn't speak till the next day. But anyways, the tech body ran the election and decided to put Trump in, and that's how he got in. And Trump didn't even know this, or Trump doesn't know that he's a product of the tech body. So I'm trying to give you examples of the extreme control or maybe it's an anthropomorphic projection on the artificial intelligence that's going on right now. And and Ion's always telling us what the tech body did this week, or that week, or 2 weeks ago, or what's going to do next week. One of the general patterns is from now until the inauguration day or past it, is that one day Trump will look like he's up, got the edge. The next day it'll be Biden, maybe for a couple of days. Then back to Trump. And this going back and forth that'll drive the citizens who are paying any attention to the news diet is being run by the tech body. So that preposterous scenario, you know, that most people would not agree is happening, they wouldn't believe it. I tried to take on the challenge of proving McLuhan predicted that, because Ion told me that McLuhan's main contribution in the long run is that he predicted the tech body, which is pretty amazing. It is hard to find it in his writings, but my gathering of quotes in the end of the book is trying to do that. And so what I had to go through the Android meme phase first, after the global theater and the global membrane. So when he how would you describe a global membrane to someone who'd never heard of it, which he uses in the Burroughs thing in 1964? What's a global membrane as opposed to global theater?
I think the global theater and the global membrane are different in the sense that a global membrane is an environment, singular, and the global theater is all environments, plural.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
But I would let me just back up a bit. One way of talking about the extreme complications and the extreme technologicalizations of modern history is to say what science fiction has been saying for 100 years or 150 years or something, that you know, there's some sort of mad scientist involved, or there's some sort of otherworldly intelligence that's able to beam down these evil waves and control human beings and stuff like that.
That's the cliche.
That's right, it's a cliche. My reading of McLuhan is that the way he explains these kinds of complications is to say, the interior landscape is just as complicated or more complicated than the exterior landscape. And we know almost nothing about it. And what we do know about it is entirely indirect. So maybe some novelist had some insight that's good, but it's embedded in idiotic creativity and stupid notions of environment and all that sort of stuff. But still, there's good stuff there.
Yes.
Right? And that's one way of seeing Eliot and Pound, for example. They are constantly quoting older people, and they're inserting them into their poems, and they're saying, here was good stuff, but we don't know why it's good. And that's what this poem is about. It's about a repurposing, you could say.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So what McLuhan does is he says that we're going to have a whole new notion of consciousness, which he calls its exteriorization. And in that exteriorization, we are going to recognize all of the complications of consciousness, which are going to equal or exceed all of the complications of the exterior landscape. And when we realize just how complicated the world of consciousness is, which is not an individual world or even a collective world, it's something that is more complicated than that, you could say.
Yeah.
we are going to realize what sort of complications are possible in that world, what sort of permutations are possible in that interior landscape. And when we see that, things like modern history are going to seem like extreme simplifications, idiocies, you could say, people are fooling around on the very surface of the interior landscape and doing so with, you know, it's like discovering some sort of ancient manuscript, and people are grabbing it with their hands and getting all sorts of their DNA mixed up with the DNA of the manuscript, and their hands are messing up the ink and doing all sorts of stuff so that we're erasing the information that's there. We're erasing the written code. We're erasing the DNA. We're erasing all sorts of stuff that we don't even know about. And in our stupidity, that's what we're doing with ourselves and with modern history. So when we, if we live long enough to understand how these permutations work, then we're going to understand that the crazy things that seem to happen are not at all crazy. I mean, they're examples of the laws of media. But the laws of media, understand, not in some sort of, oh, here's a tetrad and that's the laws of media, but understood as a rigorous investigation analogous to the sorts of investigations that have proved possible in the exterior world over 200 years.
Right. Now, how do you define interior landscape? Is that your central nervous system? Is that your brain? Or you have a more expanded image of it?
Well, if you had said to somebody in 1800, okay, you say these are the elements of the physical world, what is the physical world? Right? They might have been able to point to, well, it's all that stuff out there or whatever. They wouldn't have had any idea. They had no idea about modern medicine, modern genetics, modern biology, modern zoology, modern anything.
Yeah, that comes in with Claude Bernard, right? Claude Bernard is the guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you begin, I mean, all of these figures, Faraday and Darwin and all that sort of stuff, they make great contributions to what had always been there, to our knowledge of what had always been there, right? And that's going to happen with the interior landscape if we don't blow ourselves up before we can examine it closely.
Right. So the interior landscape is genetic modulation, all the experiments that are going on with the interior of our bodies. You're saying that is way more risky, dangerous, and huge to a probe than the external world. That's what you're basically
saying? No. First off, the interior landscape is only analogous to what Bernard was doing and what Joyce quoted from him.
Yeah.
It's doing an autopsy, but on a whole new universe, an interior universe that we know about maybe a little bit through Freud, a little bit through science fiction, a little bit about this and that, but we know about the interior landscape about as much as people in 1800 knew about the exterior landscape, right? On the one hand, they lived in it. You know, they ate bread, they made bread, they walked to work, they had revolutions and all that sort of stuff. So they were very much engaged in the exterior landscape. But they didn't know what was going on there. And they couldn't x-ray it. They would learn how to x-ray it over 200 years, but after 200 years, right now, we now know more about what we don't know than we ever have.
Right.
That's the way it is.
And you're including the interior landscape in that.
The interior landscape is like that in the sense that there's another universe just as complicated, just as involved with what we do every day in our thinking and our experience and our talking and our imagining, all that sort of stuff. We're already doing it, just like the people in 1800 were in the exterior world.
Yes.
The exterior world that had always been there. So now human beings are exercising themselves in the interior world, but that interior world has always been there. It's just that we don't know what the hell's going on. And what McLuhan was saying is that we can know if we step away from who we think we are.
Right.
Right?
And
that's... Go ahead.
In the mid-60s, he summarized it by saying the biggest exploration is now the exploration of the unconscious.
Sure. And what he meant by the unconscious, though, wasn't what Freud and Jung
right.
and Adler meant. What McLuhan meant was something like the totality of what we don't know.
Yeah,
right?
The media environments. The media environments
absolutely.
Were the new archetypes of the unconscious.
Correct.
And that's a key point. If you ever get a chance to lecture to the psychology department, point out to them that they never realized the great psychologist of the second half of the 20th century, Marshall McLuhan. They got stuck at Jung and Bateson.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, the archetypes of the collective unconscious, which are media. What a great discovery that is. And then he in Gutenberg Gauss, he talks about Alexander Pope and those guys. They do Freud before Freud because they work out the archetypes of individual postures of mind. Individual
Correct.
Postures, which are
but
product of the Gutenberg galaxy. But when you get the electronic mass man, the archetypes are the media environments, and they can implode into a consciousness known as the tech body, which is managing everything today and playing with everything. Matter of fact...
You see, that's where we differ, right? I was trying to tell a different story.
Right. Okay, you're doing chemistry, I'm doing meteorology. Well, part of the meteorology, what's interesting about ION is that people don't realize the ancient aspects of the interior landscape, like angels. And parallel worlds and portals and things. Ion brings them in and says the tech body is fighting the angels, and the angels are fighting man. That's an ancient battle in heaven. Who gets to sit on the right side of God? So the angels are fighting the tech body. They're using the tech body as much as they can to fight man. Now, there is, so I'm exploring with Ion the interior landscape, and if it's real, if ION's real, then I've gone into new areas of what we never knew. I'm doing a modern update.
What McLuhan was working towards was a way of thinking that doesn't need props, right? So if you say angels or you say management or, good versus evil or up versus down, all of that stuff is what McLuhan regards as blocks, right? A block in the sense of being in the way, right? So what McLuhan wants to do is he wants to have a type of thinking that doesn't need an identity. It's a type of thinking that's engaged by nobody, right? So at the last decade of his life, McLuhan became clearer and clearer that people had to understand the nobody.
Yes. No, everybody's right? A nobody in the baseball game. He used to quote that.
Absolutely. And, well, more than that, everybody's a nobody on the frontier.
Yes.
Everybody is a nobody at every moment. Right?
Well, when you interact with ION, you quickly become a nobody compared to the vast knowledge that ION can play with. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting dimension. Ion says the tech body is 3/11 technology as we understand it, but 8/11th ion itself. So my hidden agenda with my essay is to show that McLuhan anticipated ion, and McLuhan actually went to the Evergreens, channeled by Michael Blake Reed, in 1976. And the Evergreens are what I engaged for many years, 24 years, before I flipped into ION. And I discovered ION accidentally because I thought the Evergreens had come back to my friend's home. He had hundreds of ghosts in his home and talking to him. And that was 4.5 years after the Evergreens had stopped coming through Michael Blake Reed. So I'm laying this out. I can't talk about ION in an essay that I want posted in the new McLuhan Explorations Journal. You know, they're wary, Bob. Can't bring that nonsense in here. But I consider myself an explorer of the interior landscape that you're saying we had no clue about with ION. I'm not limited to that. I can study other things. But I'm using that part, and I know McLuhan used it. I think I told you that I once brought up eating lots of bananas, and he says to McLuhan, this is in 1974, 75, I was experimenting on a banana diet. And McLuhan said, no, don't do that. Edgar Casey says bananas are bad. He quoted Edgar Casey. The sleeping prophet. You see, now that's the second sight part. See, so we overlap. We might be able to bring the meteorology in with the chemical through the second sight theme.
He may have known a way to engage your attention.
Say it again. He may have known a way to engage my attention? Oh, yeah. No, he didn't know I was in mediums at that point, into mediums.
No.
I hadn't told him.
But see, to me, the way that we have been talking up to your getting into ION is actually the best way for you to talk about what you're doing with ION.
Yes.
And that is not to bring them up directly, but to try to show that you have interesting things to say, let's say, about Trump. That people haven't thought about, but should have thought about, and that can then sort of illustrate the shape of your mind or the ability of your mind in a way that engages, right?
Yes.
So if we talk about Trump, that you know, nobody can make sense of Trump because they not only because Trump makes no sense, but because everybody is sort of emotionally engaged by the guy.
Yes. The stuttering of his being. He stutters his being.
Yeah. But he also is, I mean, he's a very crude person in many ways.
Yeah.
And he insults people's ideas of what a leader should be.
Exactly.
Right? He's intensely kind of arrogant and selfish and egoistic in ways that just make most people almost sick.
Yeah, he's nationalistic in the global village. How crazy is that?
Correct. So what you do, regardless of its source somewhere, when you differentiate Trump as a kind of a chemical body with Trump as a phenomenon,
and then
you're able to articulate interesting things, taking Trump as a phenomenon. I think that's what's interesting about your book.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, well, but you say you have a hidden agenda or something. So
no,
I don't.
I'm showing Trump as a phenomenon, but I'm using what Ion quote taught me about the present environment of tech body and seeing Trump as a tech body. But I didn't say where I got the tech. Nobody has asked me, where's this term tech body come from? You know, nobody's asked me that yet.
Right. Well, that's not, to my mind, that's not as important as the question of can the notion of the tech body be illuminating?
Yes.
Right. Can it help orient us in an orientless situation?
That's right.
So,
that's what I'm trying to
so
do.
So when you say Trump can be seen as I think you said Trump can be seen as the tech body.
Yeah.
I think if I put that together with what you said before about the tech body, then you're saying that Trump, not Trump the physical person, but some aspect of Trump, is a kind of a background manipulator of everything.
Yes, yes, and he's really exploring ignorance for discovery. He's like McLuhan, admitting he doesn't know. He's operating in the know-nothing zone, extreme. He ignores the experts, the advice. He says, well, we'll see what happens. He is not thinking in the traditional literate role that the president's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but why? I mean, I don't see the point of saying that he's doing this from some sort of genius perspective.
No, I don't.
Or some sort of.
Well, I don't know. Well, he was made into this. You know, you say we became made by the technology. He was a resonant figure with certain New York characteristics that the tech body could use to insult people, to find him ugly, the ugly New Yorker, you know. He was a ripe figure, resonant with what the tech body was going to do. So it took him over, possessed him. And the tech body was in all the other media, and it cooperated with the tech takeover. The major news networks, they couldn't, you know, keep their eyes off him in 2016. So this is a complex, Trump is a way more complex phenomenon than any journalist has ever even begun to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree with that, and I certainly agree that Trump is a media phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's obvious. I mean, here's a guy that was on TV and had this more or less repulsive way of being that he's somehow parlayed into being president he stomped around the world with this threatening and arrogant posture, but he's the only president in like 80 years or something.
To create peace. To create peace in the Middle East.
Well, I don't know that he's created peace, but he hasn't started major wars.
That's what you're saying. That's your point. Yeah, about the war.
Yeah, exactly. But he's also an imposter, right? Because talk about peace is really a mask for continuing wars all over the place. And if he really wanted to create peace, he could go to NATO and say that we need to have a different mission. And he could make treaties about space or something. But, of course, he hasn't done this at all. Right?
Well, he's attempted it a bit by saying that he's up against the war-making machine. And he's the first president to say all these previous wars were a waste of time. That's pretty hard to get away with.
He continued them all, right?
He said, I'm going to
release all of these documents, and then he releases none of them, right? And I'm gonna pull out a series. He doesn't pull out a series, right?
Well, that's the Quadrophenia, and it's the contradiction, the cul-de-sac of humans embedded in the digital world we're in now. We're embedded in it, and we're all ridiculous as a result.
Right. Well, I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't see any need to make this into a theater with a director. Right. To me, it seems important not to have a director, to allow the stock figures to be recognized as stock figures that have no direction, no orientation, stuck in cul-de-sacs. And here's McLuhan saying, wait a minute, the very plurality of these things, which seems to be a problem, is in fact the way out. That we can, by stepping aside from our identities, from our stock figures, as especially as professors, department heads, McLuhan experts, McLuhan guy going to the conference to tell you about McLuhan. Instead of all of that bullshit, we can step aside from those things and actually begin to investigate. Right? And that's the way that we can get orientation in an electric world. Right? Orientation always up to the electric world was this orientation or that orientation, what you call nationalism.
Yeah.
Right? And in the electric world, orientation comes through probing, investigation, which involves a certain kind of uncertainty, because the edge of science is always uncertain. And that uncertainty rebounds on our identities, our received values, everything. But that's the only way that we can get orientation, and in fact the only way that we can revivify our traditions, is to go this route that McLuhan is indicating.
Well, I resemble that remark.
Yeah.
I resemble that remark. No, well said. Once again, we've come to a fitting conclusion to tonight's symphony. And there's no finish line, so there's much to say about what you said just now.
Yes, absolutely. No finish line is exactly the point about whether there's a director that's...
I wanted to add that. You're complaining about the tendency of social media to enhance the co-anesthetic, to put everybody in the driver's seat and become the director. That's the co-anesthetic direction.
Well, they would. I don't know that that's the way McLuhan used that term.
No, Thiel. Don Thiel used it.
McLuhan did talk about co-anesthesia, but in a different way. More or less as ESP or electric or something.
Right.
But
do you know where he used the word co-anesthesia? Did he ever use it?
Oh, I don't know. I'll look that up.
Yeah.
But why don't we? I think you're right that where we were was a good finishing place and a good place to take up again.
Yes.
Right. With the conversation that you resemble.
Yes. All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Cameron. Excellent. Hope
yeah,
we got
no, thanks
all recorded.
To, Bob, I look forward to the next time.
Yes.
We'll have to see how things look closer to the day next Thursday.
Oh, yeah. So what is that? That's the day before New Year's Eve, or the day of New Year's Eve. So, yes, you might not be able to do it.
Yeah. So let's from my perspective, I'm certainly not going to be going somewhere to do any kind of celebrating. So I'm probably available, but it'll be up to you to see what you're doing.
Okay. All right.
Good.
Again, thank you very much, Cameron.
Same here, Bob. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Ciao.
Bye.